You offered to furnish me sufficient proof that you are not a saint, and the dance master is calling an allemande. But I gave my last dance to you, I protested. I believe two consecutive dances are permitted during war. I don't think that's the etiquette at all, sir. Only a saint would give a care for etiquette, Hamilton replied with a wink. So far, your proofs in that regard are sadly lacking, Miss Schuyler. The words were designed to ensure I gave way, which I did, and the dance became a flirtation set to music. A series of figures, handholds, and passes that had Hamilton turning beneath my arms before twirling me into his. When we interlaced hands, I felt the heat of him, and when I turned again, his hand brushed the nape of my neck. A shocking sensation. Was it merely a slip, or had he intended it? Then it happened again. This time, as he turned, his palm stroked the small of my back, and then a little lower. The rules of this dance precluded all touch except for linked arms and hand clasps, so it was no mistake. Perhaps I ought to have put a stop to it, but I'd foolishly agreed to prove I wasn't a saint. And then there was the problem that I liked the stolen touches. Round and round we twirled until I felt as if I were falling into his arms, and in his extraordinary eyes I sensed the Nyx, a figure of Dutch legend whose sweet songs lure maidens to dangerous depths for a kiss. I shall not dissemble or hide behind virtue and claim that I wasn't tempted. Hamilton was a winsome man with captivating eyes. He might have charmed me entirely if he hadn't known himself to be so charming, and if I hadn't known this dance meant nothing. It was only to inspire jealousy. It was all play pretend, except of a very grown-up variety. The next morning was impossibly more frigid, but inside I burned. As Kitty groaned about having consumed too much rum punch, and Angelica complained that her ink was frozen, I was still dreaming of the ball. I'd finally danced with Tillman, whose courtly manner did him great merit, with another of Washington's aides, Lieutenant Colonel McHenry, a medical doctor who made me laugh by reciting the worst poetry I'd ever heard, and with the stately Baron von Steuben, whose shiny military medal caught upon my lace sleeve, entangling us briefly to the amusement of all. I'd even sat a spell with the now married Benedict Arnold, who asked me with genuine fondness to thank my father for his help in trying to secure him a new post at West Point, now that his ruined leg left him unfit for active service. But there was something about Hamilton that lingered beyond the impression of any of these men, and it was not merely those captivating eyes or the heat of his hands when he touched me during our dance. His intelligence, wit, and devotion to duty were plain for all to see. But it seemed to me that Hamilton had built around himself a sparkling citadel of courtly manner and playful flirtation. He'd allowed me, for just a moment, to glimpse past it. And I thought I'd seen wounds. Wounds that perhaps couldn't be healed. But I had the ridiculous notion that given the opportunity, I'd like to try. And it was a ridiculous notion, because while Hamilton had made a powerful impression upon me, I didn't believe I had made any upon him. He seemed to give no thought to me beyond my acquaintance with Kitty, with whom he engaged in some manner of hot and cold courtship. "Ladies," Hamilton said later that morning, doffing his cap to us where we sat with mending work. He'd come to escort us to religious services. "Seeing you seated at the fire with your spindle, thread, and scissors, I cannot help but think of the three fates." Angelica playfully snapped her shears. "Do you imagine that we're measuring out the length of your life and deciding where to snip it?" Feeling at quite the disadvantage when it came to ancient stories, I left it to Kitty to scold, "You should rather think we are the three graces." Hamilton grinned.
"Oh, but I would not hazard a guess as to which of you was charm, grace, or beauty. After all, the last time a mortal man awarded a golden apple to the fairest, he caused a dreadful war.
Is that how this got started? Angelica asked. He laughed in a way that told me he admired my sister's wit as well as her beauty, and quite unfortunately, that made me like him all the better. Because the churches of Morristown had been converted to hospitals, religious service was to take place in the home of the Reverend. We'd attended both Dutch and Anglican services as children, but not Presbyterian. So as I fetched my coat, I asked, "You're certain we'll be welcome, though we aren't of the denomination?"
"The very same question His Excellency asked," Hamilton replied. "The Reverend replied it was not the Presbyterian table, but the Lord's table."
Thus, in our best church dresses, coats, hats, and scarves, Angelica, Kitty, and I took our communion. But Hamilton did not. Surely he's a Christian, I thought, but I couldn't muster the courage to ask. On the way back, we strolled by a frozen pond, where Colonel Tillman was most solicitous of me. Hamilton had the idea of a sledding party for the week next, which occasioned McHenry to taunt him in his Irish brogue. "He might be a silver-tongued courtier in a ballroom, ladies, but you've never seen a lass less made for winter sport."
"Allow me to put that to the lie," Hamilton said, launching a snowball at McHenry, who, like a naughty, laughing leprechaun, ducked behind the taller Tillman as cover to return the volley.
Then ensued the most delightful mayhem. Slipping and sliding and thrashing one another as they ran, Washington's aides acted like brothers, I thought. Even in their horseplay, the strapping officers who rode into nearly every battle with our general were all athletic grace. But when a shower of snow came our way, Angelica asked with feigned sternness, "Must we negotiate a truce, gentlemen?" From behind a fortress he'd made of a tree, Hamilton replied, "I'm afraid it's victory or death for me."
"Don't believe it, ladies," McHenry quipped with bawdy mischief. "He'll surrender his sword to any pretty girl who wants it. 3 by my account in the last month alone."
"Have a care, Mac,"
Colonel Tillman scolded, as if worried to offend my maiden ears. But everyone else laughed, and in truth, I knew not what to make of Hamilton's rakish reputation.
"Make way!"
came a command from down the narrow, frozen lane, where we stood watching the men's antics. Clutching hands to keep our balance, we trudged into a deeper drift of untrodden snow as a war-weary company of men paraded by. Their threadbare uniforms were familiar, of course, as were the abused muskets upon their shoulders and the malnourished gaunt upon their frostbitten faces. But one thing was strikingly different about these soldiers. They were black. A thing that perhaps shouldn't have so surprised me, for I'd heard Papa talk about the black troops who served at Saratoga. But a few of these men wore the gold epaulettes of an officer, a thing that I'd never before heard about or seen. Our escort saluted the white colonel at the head of the column, who returned the gesture and shouted out more commands to his men.
"The first Rhode Island," Hamilton said to me as they passed, perhaps sensing my surprise. "Our first black regiment."
McHenry nodded and spoke in his thick brogue.
"And we'll need 'em, too. We lose too many men to disease and desertion to refuse blacks in the army now, and those with reservations voice their concerns no longer. The British recruitment of slaves has convinced most Americans that we should do the same,"
Tillman said, glancing amongst us ladies, as if he wished to make sure we knew his sentiments on the matter.
"As if the standard of humanity did not make them deserving of freedom enough."
"And the other men don't mind serving with them?" Angelica asked, and I knew precisely why. For our father had complained that black troops disgraced our arms. But I was glad that Angelica had asked instead of me, because Hamilton actually frowned at her.
"The contempt we've been taught to entertain for Negroes makes us fancy many things that are founded neither in reason nor experience, as my dear Lawrence's project in South Carolina is sure to prove."
This was the second time I'd heard him mention John Lawrence, and I'd since learned that the Southerner was another of Washington's aides,
now away on different business, and an officer, like Hamilton, with an unfailing ability to work his way into the gazettes. Lawrence's most recent fame came as a result of suggesting we give freedom to slaves willing to fight in the army. "Lawrence seeks to raise a black regiment in South Carolina?" I asked. I could scarcely contemplate it. If a northern plantation owner with only a few slaves, like my father, hadn't approved of Lawrence's scheme, I could only imagine how outlandish and dangerous southern planters would deem the idea. But Hamilton seemed to admire his friend's audacity.
"If Lawrence has any fault, it is an intrepidity bordering upon rashness, but in that he is excited only by the purest motives."
It was rash. But now I found myself surrounded by men fighting for freedom. Everyone's freedom, it seemed. And I couldn't help but feel sympathetic to the idea. For didn't the men of that Rhode Island regiment marching past show the same fidelity, do the same duty, draw upon the same courage, and make the same sacrifices? What more could a country ask of its citizens, let alone its slaves? Chapter 8. The longer I spent in the company of the army, the more I felt within my breast the desire to contribute to the cause. So I went the next day with my aunt and uncle to the Presbyterian church that had been commandeered for a hospital. As we approached the adjoining cemetery, we found two soldiers with axes breaking the frozen ground for a grave. A stiff corpse lay in the snow, arms bent at a grotesquely unnatural angle, his mouth locked as if in a silent shriek.
"Will there be no coffin for the poor soul?" I asked.
"There's no time if it's a contagion."
My uncle had been instrumental in inoculating the army against smallpox, and me and my siblings as well when we were younger, checking this most dreaded epidemic after Valley Forge. Still, the soldiers suffered typhus and flux, fevers and dysentery, measles and mumps.
"When we made winter quarters here 3 years ago, we were forced to dig a mass grave. Sickness in the army was much worse then, and smallpox carried away a fourth of the town, too."
No wonder the people of Morristown treated us coldly. If the army brought with it pestilence and hardships, the townsfolk could scarcely be happy to have the army back again. And the words of the irritated sentinel came back to me now, haunting me with their literal meaning. "They're just sick to death of us."
"You're a good-hearted girl, Betsy," my uncle warned. "But what you've seen in an Albany hospital won't prepare you."
Carrying a bundle of bandages, Aunt Gertrude patted my shoulder.
"Pay him no mind, dear. Dr. Cochrane has mistaken you for some milk-and-water miss. He forgets you're a Schuyler."
Like my mother, Aunt Gertrude had learned rudimentary medicine at the barn my family turned into a hospital at Schuyler Flats during the French and Indian War. She was sturdy and strong and expected me to be the same. So with that reminder ringing in my ears, I braced myself to witness with my own eyes the horrors my uncle thought would shock me. Inside the church, officers lay upon church pews, but the rank and file rested on naught but piles of straw. Nurses moved amongst the groaning mass of patients, emptying chamber pots, combing hair for lice, and dousing everything with vinegar as a purifier. It was too cold to remove my police coat and fur-lined hood. I had no choice but to shed my calfskin gloves, however. So I left them upon the altar before fetching a bucket of vinegar water.
"May I tend you, sir?"
I asked as a fevered man retched into the straw, too ill to answer. I sponged the sweat from the back of his neck and had just given him a small sip of wine posset to settle him when my aunt was called to help my uncle amputate the frozen feet of a sentry.
"Please let the sentry swoon,"
I prayed as his scream soon broke past the bullet upon which he was to bite down. At the very least, I hoped he'd been given rum to ease his pain, but I feared otherwise because he wasn't an officer and we were rationing the rum. I turned to see his black toes and severed flesh flung into a bloody bucket.
and I feared I might disappoint Aunt Gertrude's expectations because bile rose and my stomach rolled. It was only with great effort that I made myself go about my duties, as if screams were not echoing off the high ceiling of the nave. At length, the screaming stopped. My uncle abandoned his bloody instruments, snapped off his gore-speckled apron, and uttered a curse for which he immediately begged God's pardon. Wearing a grim expression, Aunt Gertrude called for a stretcher.
"He can't have died," I said.
"Soldiers could live without toes, without fingers, feet, arms, and legs, too."
"'Twas the pain," Aunt Gertrude replied.
"Before that, I hadn't known someone could perish from pain alone. Since then, I have learned it to be true, but learned the opposite as well, that stubborn life can cling to a person, even when they are in such pain that they wish they would die." Aunt Gertrude murmured a prayer and told me to return to my tasks. A few moments later, the church door opened and closed against a sharp winter wind, and Alexander Hamilton strode past me.
"Dr. Cochrane," Hamilton said from close enough that I could hear the men's conversation, "we're suffering a nearly complete depletion of medicinal supplies, and His Excellency will need a much fuller accounting of your request."
My uncle stood, rinsing his hands in a bucket.
"As explained in our letter, at present, the patients bed down together. Pox victims next to amputees, pneumonia sufferers, cough on boys with dysentery, and so on. We ought to separate them, and to do that, we need more hospitals." "That I understand, sir," Hamilton said, "but I'm still left bewildered as to why you should need gunpowder."
Though I didn't know it then, more than any of Washington's other aides-de-camp, Hamilton was an all-seeing eye over each munition and every last kernel of corn, and he looked aghast when my uncle explained that he wanted to burn precious gunpowder to purify putrid air. I thought the willingness of our doctors to experiment was laudatory, but Hamilton's fingers flicked in annoyance.
"The general finds the application for gunpowder unusual and doesn't think it proper to authorize it."
I was startled by the impression that Hamilton was speaking for George Washington without asking, as if he were empowered to do so.
My uncle looked as if he might argue, but was too weary. "Perhaps we might discuss this later, Colonel." "I cannot imagine the answer will change," Hamilton said with great officiousness. "But I don't wish to keep you from your work."
With that, he turned to go, quite nearly stumbling over me where I crouched to tend a patient.
"Miss Schuyler, I didn't expect to see you. I'm astonished to find you here."
Rising to my feet with a pail of vinegar water, I said, "Surely you know Dr. Cochrane is my uncle." Hamilton's gaze traveled the length of me, as if to be sure the girl he'd last seen in a brocaded gown could be the same one now before him in a nurse's apron.
"Of course, but I didn't realize. Most belles could not withstand these sights and indelicate smells."
I was not, of course, immune to the putrid perfume of sweat, vomit, urine, and blood, but my discomfort hardly mattered. "I'm bothered more by the suffering than the smell."
Hamilton nodded. "Another statement that serves as poor proof against your sainthood."
I smiled. "Then my aunt must also be a saint, and Mrs. Washington, who tends the soldiers sometimes too. How can I do less if God has given me the capacity?" He returned my smile, and his gaze lingered on my face.
"Far be it from me to question God. I bid you good day, Miss Schuyler."
"To you as well," I replied, watching him go. But he'd only marched 5 steps before he stopped, paused, then turned back.
"I neglected to mention that another storm may be coming. If so, you won't want to be caught here after dusk. I'd be happy to escort you and save your aunt and uncle the trouble of conveying you home."
It wouldn't save them any trouble at all. But there was something about the way he'd debated making the offer that intrigued me, even though it could be nothing but a flimsy pretext to pay call upon Kitty.
But I had completed the chores my aunt set for me, and thought that perhaps I could use the opportunity to speak on my uncle's behalf. And, in truth, I wanted to go with him. So I washed, retrieved my gloves, and allowed him to hold the door for me as we left the church. "Colonel Hamilton, are you certain His Excellency would deny Dr. Cochrane's request?" I asked, as we stepped outside and walked together down the snowy lane. Hamilton seemed amused that I might question him.
"I know your uncle to be an excellent and learned physician, but I also studied medicine at King's College before the war. And when I explain my reservations about the safety of burning gunpowder in a wooden church, and remind General Washington of the scarcity of our resources, I'm sure he'll see the absurdity of it."
"If you studied medicine, Colonel, then you should know that smoke smudging is an old and revered medicine. I've seen it practiced by the Iroquois as a cleansing ritual, albeit not with gunpowder."
"At long last, a detail of your sojourns among the Indians that Tillman neglected to mention,"
he said with a teasing smirk as we passed under tree boughs that sagged with the weight of new-fallen snow.
"Nevertheless, I can only put to His Excellency a plan to part with supplies in the interest of science, not superstition."
That should have ended the matter. Normally, I wouldn't have inquired further, but something about Hamilton provoked me. Our men at Valley Forge were ignorant of the science behind cooking white corn. It was the Oneida allies my father and Lafayette recruited who taught them better. Remembering how Hamilton spoke reprovingly to Angelica about the unfair ways we'd been taught to view Negroes, I added, "Perhaps you dismiss Indian medicine as superstition with unfair prejudice." Hamilton's mouth opened, then snapped shut again.
"Certainly our Indian allies have proved invaluable to our cause, and they deserve the respect of humanity. However,
then I appeal to your humanity to give the doctor what he requires." Hamilton laughed, which was not at all the reaction I'd wished.
"Had you appealed to my friendship or gallantry, it would have been irresistible. I should think myself bound to attack windmills in your service. But when you appeal to the general principle of humanity, I must show you that even the eloquence of your plea cannot tempt our Fabius to do wrong."
"Fabius?"
"I mean General Washington, of course. Who, like the Roman hero of old, pursues a strategy of evading and wearing down the enemy, avoiding pitched battles and, above all, conserving supplies."
Hamilton obviously had done some cold manner of calculation, weighing sickness against the possibility of battle, deciding the gunpowder could not be spared. So I did not press him further. Instead, we walked in silence, only the sound of the snow crunching underfoot between us, until I had to ask, "Are we losing the war, Colonel?" It was an impulsive question, one that Hamilton shouldn't have answered, but he did.
"Yes, we're losing the war."
I was so surprised by his candor that I slipped on the ice. He caught me by the arms and steadied me until we stood facing one another, and his blue eyes again gave the impression of violet against the bleakness of all that surrounded us.
Is it because of the desertions?" I asked.
"Miss Schuyler, I begin to worry you are utterly destitute of the frivolousness which is justly deemed one of the principal accomplishments of a belle."
"I shall take that as a compliment, sir."
"I'm not sure I meant it as one," he said.
I swallowed against a sudden unexpected wanting and took a step back. "Still, you were saying about the war."
He shrugged as we resumed walking. "We're losing the war for 1,000 reasons, starting with the fact that you arrived here not long after a mutiny. We're not sure how much longer we can hold this army together. Oh, militia will fight if you pick a time and place and send a pretty invitation, but the hard slog of a disciplined army ready to strike whenever opportunity presents itself is what's necessary."
It was part of the trouble my father faced with militias and the Green Mountain Boys, so I understood. What he said next, I understood less.
"Then there is the deranged state of our currency. The value of paper money has dwindled to nothing, and the necessity of a foreign loan is now greater than ever."
He glanced at me before summarizing, Our affairs are in a bad way, but perhaps Europe will save us in spite of ourselves. If Lafayette returns with assistance from France, it could change everything.
Fortunately, I know the Marquis to be resourceful.
So he is.
Hamilton's expression softened.
I forget that even if you know nothing of old Romans, you are Schuyler's daughter and a woman of the world.
Is it your way to taunt and flatter in the same breath?
It is when I'm trying to win a lady's admiration.
I slanted him a glance. Is that what you're trying to do? He peered down at me, the hint of a smile around too pretty of a mouth.
I sense that you disapprove of me, Miss Schuyler. Though it is assuredly my own fault, it is fast becoming a circumstance I cannot bear.
Did he really care so much what I thought of him? I confess no such disapproval, sir.
Only indifference.
A little smile tugged at the corners of my mouth as we sparred. I do not confess to that either. He slowed, staring at me a moment.
I meant it for a compliment.
Pardon?
Before, when I chastised you for earnestness.
He cleared his throat.
You took it for a compliment, and I meant it as one. I was too embarrassed to say so.
Too embarrassed? So he did care what I thought of him? A fact that delighted me more than it should. Why would it embarrass you?
He dug his hands into the pockets of his coat. Because you possess a very strange charm, and you reveal to me a weakness in my fortifications against your sex. I've built a bulwark against guile, and I have no weapon against sincerity.
I didn't realize the sexes were in battle.
Always, he replied with an arch smile. The eternal one. Against marriage. Against the delusion that two people can make one another happy for a lifetime. It is a dog of a life when two dissonant tempers meet, and 'tis 10 to 1 in this case.
Then you are a foe of love.
Never love, only marriage. Miss Livingston might have once laid claim to my heart. I ran a great chance of being ostracized by my fellows for dedicating so much time to so trifling and insignificant a toy as woman. But all for love is my motto.
Kitty had hurt him somehow, I realized. Or some woman did. Which is why I decided not to cut his pompous self-regard to ribbons. Kitty can be fickle.
He ducked his chin into the collar of his greatcoat. I would not give her the blame. I am a stranger from the West Indies. I have no property here in this country, no connections. If I have talents and integrity, these are very spurious titles in these enlightened days.
So Hamilton was a foreigner. That explained his slight accent, or rather the way in which he suppressed one. That he wasn't from the colonies was of no consequence to me whatsoever, but I noted the bitterness. And yet your origins have not prevented you from a trusted place in Washington's inner circle. Does that not fill you with hope for your future?
I try not to think of a future. When I was a child, I wished for a war to improve my circumstance, and now war has been the whole of my life since the start of the Revolution. So I expect to mingle my fate with America's should she lose her struggle.
It was an admirable sentiment, if expressed with almost a sadness that made me wish to reassure him. But what if we win? He gave me an indulgent look, as if he thought me hopelessly optimistic.
Then I will turn away from the corruption of the world and retire to a frugal life in the countryside, roasting turnips, like the general Menius Curius Dentatus.
Another old Roman, I guessed. He seemed fascinated by them. But when he saw the name meant nothing to me, he smirked.
I begin to think I should loan you some books.
A musty tome will not tell me what I wish to know.
Which is?
Whether you could be content planting turnips. He dug with the toe of his boot in the snow.
It sounds like a lonely business.
Now I couldn't help but twit him. Didn't Donatus have a wife to help him plant his turnips?
He grinned. I suppose he must have.
What was her name?
Hamilton paused for a heartbeat. Aquileia, a sweet and devoted woman. No coquette, not fickle in the slightest.
Would it be unkind to think you invented that name?
His eyes lit with mischief. You would have to delve into one of those musty tomes to find out.
We had, by this point, reached the door of my uncle's lodgings. But instead of opening it for me when we climbed the steps, Hamilton leaned against it to bar my way. And he sighed. "Why do you sigh?"
I asked. He didn't answer. Not precisely. "I suppose you really are a perfect little nut-brown maid with eyes like a Mohawk beauty."
"Do you mean that for a compliment?" I asked, fighting the blush that surely stained my cheeks.
"It does me no credit that you should have to ask."
He inched closer to me, and as the bow fastening my hood had come loose, he took the liberty of unraveling it completely.
"I suppose your beaux in Albany have paid you better tribute, and that, like a coquette, you've shunned them and gloried in their broken hearts."
With the ribbons of my hood in his hands, he tugged me until we were so close I thought he might kiss me. And caught up in the spell, I wanted him to, desperately. "Sir, I hope you will believe me when I say I wish to be a mender of hearts, rather than a breaker of them." It was so revealing a comment that I could have cursed myself. How cloying and hopeful and obvious. He must have taken me for a perfect child. For in that moment, he stared. Then straightened up again, patronizingly fastening my hood tightly beneath my chin.
"I can see why Tench fancies himself in love, and also why you should accept his courtship. He is the right sort of man for you, Miss Schuyler."
"I scarcely know him," I said,
not liking the turn in the conversation or how the spell had broken.
"I scarcely know you, for that matter, which makes it all the more confounding that you should presume to guess what sort of man is right for me."
"You're a very earnest girl," Hamilton replied,
as if this fact made him angry.
"My friend Tench is a very earnest fellow. From a good family, he has money. You're well matched. He's almost as much a saint as you are."
I had the distinct impression he was making a case, as if before a jury. But he didn't like his own arguments. I didn't like them either. Abruptly, he tipped his tricorn hat.
"Good day, Miss Schuyler."
Thereafter, our every encounter was inexplicably strained and abrupt. We crossed paths at headquarters, where I went to help Mrs. Washington mend socks and hats and breeches for the soldiers, and Hamilton stood dumbly in the doorway of the anteroom. A ball of wadded paper had rolled at his feet, no doubt pitched by one of his laughing comrades from where they labored with ink and quill pens. And without acknowledging me, Hamilton stooped to pick it up, then walked away without another word. A few days later, he even begged off taking us to the sledding party with a very curious note. "Colonel Hamilton's compliments to Miss Livingston and Miss Schuyler. He is sorry to inform them that his zeal for their service made him forget he is so bad a charioteer as hardly to dare to trust himself with so precious a charge. Though if he were to consult his own wishes, like Phaethon, he would assemble the chariot of the sun, even if he were sure of experiencing the same fate. Colonel Tillman offers himself a volunteer."
"This is just the dance that takes place outside a ballroom," Angelica said when I told her what had happened. "Men advance, they withdraw, they advance."
What she didn't say, but I instinctively knew, was that Alexander Hamilton was not in the category of men that ought to concern me as dance partners in or out of a ballroom. He had already blazed a brilliant career. He was a prodigy, an ambitious man, a peacock who ought to be matched with some society bird of showy plumage. He'd been perfectly clear about his hostility toward marriage. Any flirtation between us was merely an amusement. And I hadn't come to Morristown to be amused.
There are places in this world that you wash off the solid ground and, like a waterfall, send you hurtling over the precipice onto the jagged rocks of hard reality. Jockey Hollow was for me such a place. The first thing to strike me as our sleigh jingled into the forested hills of Jockey Hollow was how the pine forest suddenly fell away. Only stumps of trees remained as far as the eye could see. Almost as if some Goliath had reached down to strip the earth bare. The second was the eerie silence, as if every bird and woodland creature had fled, or been devoured. As a military sled piled with logs glided past, pulled through the snow by a Bag of Bones horse and a ragged little Pfeiffer boy, a scent of human waste assaulted my nostrils. And a worse scent, too. A scent that I could only name, even now, as suffering. For we stood amid the real encampment of the Continental Army. 4 miles away from the orderly streets of Morristown, where Washington and his officers conducted the business of war and hosted glittering winter's balls, the 10,000 unwashed, unclothed veteran soldiers lived in a wilderness city of log huts, made only of notched oak logs sealed with mud and straw, trapped by snow, and starving. I'd seen soldiers in hard times before. In Albany, I'd seen undisciplined Yankee riflemen, untrained Negro boys sent as fodder, and soldiers with neither tents to shelter them nor hats to cover their heads. But that was 3 years ago. This was a gaunt ghost of an army now made up of scarecrow men, whose hollowed, haunted eyes left me to wonder how they were alive at all. They were so hungry they had resorted to boiling their old leather shoes they needed, lest they stand upon the snow in bare feet and frostbite deaden their toes, a fate they avoided by wrapping them in rags. I didn't know that while I'd donned heels and danced and drank rum punch with officers, ordinary soldiers were sleeping 12 to each log hut, living on half rations, and wearing what only laughingly could be called a uniform. And now that I did know it, I wanted to retch up every morsel I'd eaten for the shame of it. "Betsy," my uncle said softly, trying to draw me to follow him. But his efforts were to no avail, because in the swirl of my horror, I'd noticed a man hanging by one arm on a picket, tied to one of the few remaining trees, red blood flowing from his shivering ribs, his bare back laid open in gory gashes that revealed bone. And it looked as if his shoulder had dislocated. "Dear God, he needs help," I said, starting for the poor fellow, my petticoats dragging in the snow. My uncle caught me by the arm.
"It's a military matter, Betsy."
As a general's daughter, I'd known soldiers forced to run the gauntlet and slashed by their fellows. But the sorts of punishment meted out by the British Army, 1,000 lashes like to make a man die, I'd never seen in ours. And this man's suffering seemed an utter barbarity. So I broke away from my uncle and rushed to the bloody soldier. What I would have done for him, I didn't know. Untie him, bandage him, give him my cloak. I only knew that I must do something until the miserable fellow looked up at me from his bindings and croaked,
"Listen to good Dr. Bones, lass."
His words slurred.
"There's nothing you can do. I was caught robbing the town folks."
"You've been punished for it amply," I said. "By whose orders are you left here to—"
"I was deserting,"
explained the half-frozen miscreant, his eyes glassy and his teeth chattering against the cold and the pain.
"Better than the imbecility in staying and starving for a country that cares nothing for us. They're likely to shoot or hang me come morning. So be an angel of mercy and pray for me to die."
A startled sob caught in my throat.
"Elizabeth!"
my uncle barked. This time he brooked no resistance, pulling me away by the arm and taking such long strides that I was forced to take 2 steps for his every one. "He can't be left there in agony, uncle."
"The officers will decide that. I thought your father would have taught you this. I'd never have brought you with me if I thought otherwise."
As a general, my father, too, must have ordered men flogged, or maybe even hanged. I'd never questioned Papa's decisions or his wisdom or his mercy. But to torture a man, to torture all these men.
This is no place for ladies,
my uncle was saying. Yet I spotted women everywhere, some even with children, also gaunt and starved. Camp followers, we called them, intimating they were prostitutes. Some were, but more were wives of the soldiers who, having been burned out of their homes by the British, had nowhere else to go. The women boiled water, they sewed, they cleaned clothes, and I was ashamed at myself for not bearing up better when so many of them managed to. I'm sorry, I said to my uncle. I will better conduct myself. But he'd thought better of my presence entirely.
What you'll do is go to the Wick House until I fetch you. General St. Clair has his headquarters there.
If he'd been the officer to order a man lashed to the bone, I didn't think I could face him.
Sensing my reluctance, my uncle said, don't keep me from tending the men.
Sorry for giving my uncle trouble. I nodded and grabbed up my skirts, then marched up a snowy path marked with blood from barefooted soldiers. I knocked upon the door of the little wooden farmhouse, but it wasn't St. Clair who answered. It was Alexander Hamilton. Somewhat dazed, I asked, is General St. Clair here?
I'm awaiting his return. Hamilton frowned. What the devil are you doing here?
At the moment, I was so shaken I wasn't sure. And when I didn't answer, Hamilton guided me into the small space before a roaring fire, herbs drying from the rafters and copper pots hanging on the wall. And though it was clear he wasn't pleased to see me, concern crept into his voice.
Miss Schuyler.
Is it right to torture a soldier like that?
Realizing what I must have seen, he pinched at the bridge of his nose. I didn't give that order.
My lower lip quivered. I only asked if it was right.
Miss Schuyler, we must hold the army together.
It was a cold-hearted answer, and he must have known that I thought so, because he couldn't meet my eyes. He stared at his boots, and I stared at him, hoping he would use his influence, if he could, to remedy the situation. Instead, at length, he said,
this morning I had the occasion to pass a private talking to his mates over a campfire. An Irishman, I gather. Not a wealthy soldier, nor a learned one, nor a statesman. Neither were his fellows. Indeed, they were a motley group of Yankees, Irishmen, Negroes, buckskins, and whatnot. And do you know what they were discussing?
I shook my head. I couldn't guess.
They were debating whether it was right to kill the Hessians on Christmas Day all those years ago. The men still feel sorrow over it because, they said, those Hessians had no choice to fight us. They were sent by a king.
I just stared, wondering what point he meant to make.
Remember, not wealthy, not learned, not statesmen. And yet they came to the conclusion that they were fighting for the Hessians, too. They said they were fighting so that no one might ever again be sent to die as a slave instead of a free man.
At those words, I took a sharp breath, much affected. Hamilton came closer.
If we cannot hold this army together until springtime, that's the end. We lose the war, we bow to the king, and every soldier who has fought and died in this war will have fought and died in vain. Our sacrificed rights erased from this earth.
You wrote that our sacred rights could never be erased by mortal power. Hamilton looked startled that I should remember the lines my sister recited, then made a dismissive sound at the back of his throat.
Well, I was an idealistic fool when I wrote that.
No, I whispered, my eyes blurring with tears. I didn't believe it. He was brave to write those words. Even if the army fell apart and we lost this war and those ideas perished from the earth, I would always believe he was right to express them. At the visible evidence of my distress, Hamilton reached into his coat as if to retrieve a kerchief, and finding none, took the liberty of drawing me into his embrace.
I found unexpected comfort in his strong arms, and we stood like that for a long time, awash in sadness. Eventually, he murmured into my hair,
"You are going to be the ruin of me, Betsy Schuyler."
Still teary, I spoke words muffled by our closeness.
"Why would you say so?"
When last we spoke, I returned to headquarters so distracted I couldn't remember the watchword. I could scarcely believe him or understand how it might be my fault.
"And you lay that at my feet?"
"I've behaved very badly toward you," he said, his arms still around me, warm and protective. "I am sorry for it. The truth is, Miss Schuyler, by some odd contrivance, you've found the secret of interesting me in everything that concerns you."
"Interesting him? But you've been avoiding me."
"Not enough, it would seem." He stared at me so long, I thought I'd beg him to go on, and then he did. "You aren't the only good-hearted young lady of gentle breeding in Morristown, but you're the only one who would ever come here. Which proves you deserve all I think of you and more, even if it's become extremely inconvenient for me."
"Inconvenient?"
I asked, searching those blue eyes in an effort to understand the meaningful tone of his voice. He sighed.
"Extremely.
You see, our little military family is the only family I've ever known. And because Tillman is besotted with you, I ought never to have looked in your direction, but now I cannot stop looking."
With those words, he turned my world on its axis. And while it was still spinning, he gave an exasperated little laugh.
"Oh, banish those stars in your beautiful black eyes, Miss Schuyler. Even were it not for Tench, I fear we are playing a comedy of all in the wrong and should correct the mistake before we begin to act the tragedy. I'm no fit suitor for you."
That he'd given thought to such a thing awakened something in me. "Because you're an enemy of marriage."
"Because I have no fortune, I have no family, and I'm a sinner."
"Three things that can all be remedied by the right woman," I said. It was perhaps the quickest answer I'd ever given in my life, and it seemed to take him off guard.
"I hadn't considered it that way."
I wasn't sure I believed him. He was the sort of man who seemed to think about all sides of everything. But the next thing he said made me realize that perhaps, in matters of the heart, he didn't allow himself. Releasing me from his embrace, his face reddening with chagrin, he held me at an arm's length.
"I'm afraid there remains yet one defect in my character that cannot be wiped away. I was born on the wrong side of the blanket and have no right to my name. I am a bastard," he said. His lips curling with contempt of the word or himself, I could not say. "Undeserving of a lady of your pedigree."
I would never have guessed it of him. He seemed every inch the cultivated gentleman. I'd heard rumors you were descended of Scots nobility.
"Oh, I have better pretensions than most in this country who plume themselves with ancestry. I am the grandson of the Laird of Grange. Unfortunately, my mother was a divorced woman when she married my father. Unluckily, her divorce was later deemed to be unlawful."
He said this soberly and swiftly, and there was good reason for it. Divorce was nearly unheard of, certainly scandalous, and yet I said what I believed to be the plain truth. "Colonel Hamilton, no matter the circumstances of your birth, anyone with eyes can see your merit. Why, the blemish upon your birth is merely a wrinkle in the law."
Hamilton's guarded expression softened. "You're kind to cast it in that light. Others are not so generous."
"Perhaps they envy you, since your story unmasks you as an aristocrat with a family coat of arms." I thought I said this very handsomely, but was rewarded only with dark amusement.
"One with only lint in his pockets and alone in the world. Nothing to envy."
"You haven't any family?" I asked. His fingers wrapped around mine, tentatively,
then tighter and tighter, as if he feared I would pull away when he went on to explain that in the West Indies he had a brother and an estranged half-brother, but that his father had abandoned the family and that his mother died when he was only 12. My heart pounded in an agony of sympathy for him, wondering how he'd made his way, a veritable orphan left to fend for himself. I couldn't fathom it. In no circumstance, either prosperity or wreck, would my own long-suffering father leave us to the vagaries of fate. And I realized anew how fortunate I was.
You must pardon me, Miss Schuyler. I do not speak of these things often, and in such specificity, never. It dredges up.
He didn't finish, but seemed to sense my welling pity.
I do not mean to paint a picture of me as a barefooted street urchin. Before my mother died, we had books, a silver tea set, and a covered bed.
How miserable an inventory he felt compelled to make.
What you must think.
I think that I wish to know you better.
He smiled softly. A saintly answer from a saintly girl.
For no reason I could understand, I was desperate to disabuse him of this notion. And between what I'd seen outside that camp and all that Hamilton had just revealed, I felt nearly overwhelmed with an urgent mix of emotion. Sadness, helplessness, pity, attraction, and desire. Obeying an impulse I could scarcely comprehend, I leaned forward to kiss him. He actually startled, his hands grasping at my wrists as if he meant to push me away, as if he was the sort of man who never allowed an intimacy that he didn't initiate. But then his grip on my wrists tightened and held me fast. It was as if my boldness had thrown a spark that Hamilton ignited into an all-consuming fire, for his mouth claimed mine and demanded to be claimed in return. It was no tender kiss we shared, happy and sweet. It was a kiss that tasted of grief and desperation, but also, unmistakably and forcefully, ardor. I forgot the cold. I forgot the soot and darkness of the cabin. I forgot the rank smell of the camp. Everything vanished except for that kiss and the stark terror of realizing that I was falling in love. At length, we broke apart, and Hamilton traced my lower lip, a little dazed.
Not a saint, it would seem, but an angel.
Colonel Hamilton.
Alexander, he insisted. I do believe we are on a footing for Christian names now.
Alexander, I said, enjoying the sound of it in my mouth. You should know something about me and Colonel Tillman.
He frowned deeply. Tell me.
In all the years your friend allegedly harbored feelings for me, he never confessed them to me. And I never felt more than friendship in return. He has no prior claim to my affections.
Then to the devil with Tench Tillman, Hamilton said, stroking his knuckles along my cheek. For I have serious designs upon your heart, Miss Schuyler, and I flatter myself that I am no bad marksman.
After that, Hamilton was nearly every evening in my uncle's parlor, with conversations that lasted so late into the night that my uncle groused about wishing to take his ease upon the settee, and my aunt was forced to all but oust the young officer from the house. When Aunt Gertrude had finally shooed Hamilton out the door, she'd shaken her head and said, "Oh, Betsy, of all Washington's fine young officers, you choose the stray," Kitty broke in. "There's no help for it. Betsy has always been too soft-hearted." "Well, I like Hamilton," Angelica said, rising to my defense with my nephew in the crook of one arm and a book in the other. "He's an ambitious and clever fellow. Should we win the war, there's no limit to his future, and if Betsy wants him, she should have him." Kitty shrugged, as if she didn't care one way or the other. And I hoped she didn't care. Because I did want him. Quite shamelessly, it would seem. For on a particular evening, when he pressed the advantage of my family's distraction, gossiping over mulled cider in the dining room, I made only the faintest protest against his fevered embrace.
one in which he seemed to be trying to forget the horrors of the war.
God, he groaned into my hair, I am faith and undone.
Who?
I whispered, my head thrown back, too much wishing to forget the horrors of the war myself. But as much as I desired him, I didn't wish to be just one more girl with whom he could forget.
Hamilton seemed dazed, entirely intent on kissing and nibbling the flesh beneath my ear, which was very pleasant indeed. But my question seemed to pull him back to himself.
Phaethon, I mentioned him in the letter I sent when I refused to take you to the sledding party. He was a figure of legend, the bastard of the Greek sun god. He died trying to prove his parentage by driving his father's chariot and set the world aflame. And though greatly he failed, more greatly he dared.
It sounded as if Hamilton admired the boy's hubris. And it made me remember that he had, at least 3 times in our acquaintance, alluded to easy acceptance, if not a wish, for death. He'd done so first at the ball, then in our walk home from the hospital, then again in his note about this fabled bastard boy who died trying to prove himself. And now again he was comparing himself to that boy. Which was what gave me the strength that propriety didn't to withdraw from his arms.
Colonel Hamilton, I said, forcing him to look at me.
Alexander.
He blew out a long breath, then appeared as if he was considering an apology. Before he could manage one, I laced my fingers with his and hastened to say, I am too much of a general's daughter not to understand that a soldier's courage is found in overcoming his fear of death. I swallowed, mustering my own courage to broach this, for I was keenly aware that in giving my heart to a soldier during wartime, I might lose it and him at any moment, especially since I'd already heard tales of how Washington's aides seemed to try to outdo one another in brash acts of battlefield bravery. Perhaps Hamilton was no different in this respect than Tillman or McHenry, or even their idolized, nearly mythical John Laurens, about whom they never ceased to bloat. But surely you know there are other paths to glory besides death. A little spark of surprise lit behind his eyes. And I hoped, what, exactly? That he would stop saying such things? That he would stop feeling them? That he would promise to never act on them? Or maybe, instead, that he would unburden himself to me so that he never entertained any imaginings of the glory of death ever again. But he only seemed to retreat a little behind a facade, affecting an insouciant smile and a careless tone. Not many other paths, it would seem, since General Washington pleads I am too indispensable to do anything but write his letters. My sister's words returned to me then, and I said, with the right connections, there would be no limit to your future. Fighting the blush against what I implied, I hastened to add, you're so witty and well-read, and you speak French, and you understand finance, and you're curious about seemingly every idea in philosophy. You remind me very much of... I trailed off there, in embarrassment. His eyebrow rose in question.
Major Andre.
I blinked.
Pardon me?
John Andre. Hamilton said. I suppose he was a lieutenant when you knew him. Sometimes we must treat with the enemy, and when we do, you've occasionally been the toast of the table.
It had been some time since I'd given any thought to that British officer, but I flushed to know he remembered me kindly, and to sense that Hamilton felt some jealousy.
Oh, I said, a little flustered. I was... Very fond of Major Andre, hadn't flattered to think he or any of his officers toast me, and he was, or is, a very accomplished gentleman. But no, that's not who I was going to name.
No, Hamilton asked. Some other beau, then?
I shook my head in denial, but he continued on.
I shall be cross if you compare me to my good friend Monroe, who speaks French well enough, but has a much slower wit.
To see the insecurity hidden behind Hamilton's words hurt my heart.
for he had all but obliterated every thought of any man before him. And so I rushed to tell him the plain truth. I was going to say you remind me of my sister. And please trust me when I say that is one of the highest compliments I could offer. If Angelica were a man, she would—
You've no need to convince me of Mrs. Carter's merits,
Hamilton said with a reassuring smile.